Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks very much for being with us today. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Reuters and the Board of Governors here at the FCC. It's my pleasure to introduce today's event with Professor Nan Sussman. Before we get started, just a couple of housekeeping notes and events coming up at the FCC. Before we get started, please do make sure you switch off your mobile phone as we are recording today's event on video. Give you a second to do that. And just to let you know what our upcoming events are at the club. Tomorrow, we have a lunch here with the president of Smith College, Carol Crist, who will be talking about the sudden surge of women leaders around the world, what that means for diplomacy, and why it's happening now. And in the coming week, we'll also go on a talk about Thailand and whether Thaksin is going to return to Thailand and what his homecoming would bring, that event coming up in a week or so. Now, on to the topic of the day, everybody else's homecoming and what it means to come back to a place where you were from originally. Is it difficult? What does it mean for Hong Kong people, and how does it feel? Well, we're privileged to have Nan Sussman here to tell us about it. She's done quite a bit of research all the way from New York. And also, to give a bit of perspective, we were talking earlier about why she got into this topic. And she said she started off talking about nonverbal skills and teaching people different cultural skills, and this led her into this field. So we'll have a speech from Nan and also make sure we leave some time for discussion and Q&A afterwards. Professor Sussman?
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back in Hong Kong. I lived here in 2004 with my family, and I was saying to Tara, I would be have been happy to have today's talk, a breakfast talk, since I was up at 4 o'clock this morning because of jet lag. So we could have had it quite early. I think this is a topic that many of you can relate to. Many of you have had experiences in and out of different cultures. And so I hope that you'll have some questions that we can have a discussion afterwards. You know, humans are a very peripatetic species. We are always on the move. We're always going from place to place. So there's a very long history of people moving, but an equally long history of people moving back home. And I think that we sometimes forget that people return home. In the United States, we mythologize in our primary school textbooks about the immigration to the United States and how many millions came to the U.S., but what is missing in our textbooks is the fact that people also went home. In fact, up to 40% of some immigrant groups returned to their home country. That you'll never see in the textbooks. Right now, it's estimated by the UN that about 100 million people are returning to their home countries every year. That's startling, right? So this is not a situation unique to Hong Kong. It's happening all over the world. People are returning to Central America, to West Africa. They're returning to Turkey from Germany. They're returning to Poland from the UK. People are returning everywhere. So although I'm going to be speaking this afternoon about Hong Kong experience and also a little bit about mainland experience, it is a situation which has, I think, worldwide implications. Excuse me. Just an unabashed plug for the book, but the results of this research study were published by Hong Kong University Press. And one thing I want to point out to you as a way to get started is the calligraphy on the right side of the of the cover of the book. For those who don't speak Chinese or don't read Chinese, it's often overlooked quickly. People think, oh, I don't understand that, so they don't look at it very long. And for those who do read Chinese characters, people sort of squint at it and look at it and think, well, maybe this is a classical form of Chinese that I don't really understand. In fact, this was designed by a contemporary Chinese artist named Xu Bing. Xu Bing is from Beijing, and in the 1990s he moved to the US, and he had an experience of being both in Eastern culture and Western culture, and he wanted to have his art reflect this dual culture, dual cultures. And so he created something called square word calligraphy. In fact, I don't know if some of you, I saw some of you have a copy of the book, if you look closely, this calligraphy is actually English. And what it says is it spells out the name of the book. The first character is the word return, and it says R-E-T-U-R-N, if you look closely. And the second word is migration, and the third word is and, and the fourth word is identity. So you'll look closely at it. So artists and writers have been struggling with this notion of dual identities and how to combine identities, and I'm grateful to Xu Bing for agreeing to put the title of the book into his square word calligraphy. What he's done is something that we call blending, right? Trying to take two cultural worlds and put them together. And we're going to talk a little bit now about blending cultures as opposed to being bicultural, which is to have two different ways to look at the world and be able to switch back and forth depending on the situation that you're in. So while Xu Bing sort of represents the blending idea, a colleague who many of you may know here in Hong Kong, Henry Steiner, who is a very well-known graphic designer, also has thoughts on blending versus maintaining sort of biculturality. And let me just read a quick quote from him. He says, the individual character of the elements should be maintained, maintaining its own identity while also commenting and enriching each other, like the balance of yin and yang. Combination, mixture, blending, these are useless concepts as they will result in a kind of mud. Street stalls in Hong Kong serve an understandably unique beverage called yin yang, a combination of tea and coffee. It tastes as you would imagine. The worst characteristics of both are enhanced. So his philosophy and his belief in terms of cultural elements is that they should be parallel and in some ways bicultural. And one of my favorite designs of his was an annual report for HSBC Bank. The year that he designed this, the bank had acquired a bank in New York. And so he wanted to somehow show two cultures. And I think he did it beautifully, looking at this from a sort of bicultural point of view. Of course, you'll all recognize the Statue of Liberty and a Cantonese operatic mask. But extra points if you can tell me who the lions are. Who knows where the two lions are from? Well, right. So one of them is in front of the HSBC Bank, of course, right near here. But the other is in front of the New York City Public Library. So get this man dessert. okay. So My judgment from a psychological point of view is that they're both correct, both Xu Bing in terms of talking about the blending of cultures, and I'll give you some examples of that from Hong Kong experience, but also so is Henry Steiner in terms of looking at bicultural elements where people are able to switch back and forth. When you talk about people returning to their home countries from a research standpoint, we often talk about several categories. One is repatriated refugees. We're not going to talk about them. Another category are returned sojourners. These are people who have a particular assignment, a length of time that they're going to be in another country. So students, aid workers, business employees, missionaries, so forth. And we're going to talk about them a bit in terms of mainlander returnees. The other category, which is growing exponentially, are the return migrants. And that's the group we're going to focus on for the Hong Kongers. But first, a little vocabulary lesson. All of us have in our minds, and maybe in our hearts as well, a sense of where we belong. And where we fit in best in terms of a culture, a country. And after studying this topic for 20 years, I began to see that people coalesced around different cultural identities after an international experience. And I've put them into four categories, and no doubt you feel that you fit into one of them. So let me give you some examples of each of them. The affirmative identity are people who by virtue of their overseas experience, feel a heightened sense of identity with their home country. So I interviewed an American who had lived in China. She said she was so happy to be back in the U.S. She never realized how much she enjoyed standing in line waiting to get in the bus. Living in China made her understand what it meant to be American and what values and behaviors were really important to her. So the overseas experience really strengthened or affirmed her American identity. And here is a Hong Konger who said the same thing. He said that living overseas strengthened his Chinese identity. So the Chinese culture, the tie became stronger and stronger because now that I'm back in Hong Kong with the proximity to China, I get to understand Chinese more. I guess being back, I have become even more Chinese. I would still describe myself as a Hong Kong person, but I would probably say I'm a Hong Kong Chinese. So some of the people that I met had this affirmative identity. The next one is subtractive identity. And the subtractive identity is the most prevalent among Westerners. So this is an identity which, as a result of living overseas, you no longer feel a part of your home your home culture. So Tim just mentioned he doesn't feel comfortable when he goes back to England. And it's a very common response among Westerners. An American I interviewed who had been in the Peace Corps for 2 years in Peru, working with indigenous people. So he returns to Ohio, where he's from, and he said, "When I got back to my hometown in Ohio and went to work, I fell back into hanging out evenings in the neighborhood tavern with my old buddies. After about 2 weeks of that, I gave up on the tavern. They didn't care about the problems of the Indians in Peru, and I didn't give a damn about what happened to the Indians in Cleveland." if you know baseball. It's the Cleveland Indian baseball team, right? So the most common response from Westerners going home is a subtractive identity. They no longer feel a part of their home culture. There were a couple of Hong Kongers who experienced a subtractive identity. One said, "I was very excited when I finally secured a job that enabled me to return to Hong Kong, but my enthusiasm did not last long. Without my full awareness, a decade of living in Canada had changed me. I have found that I can no longer engage in meaningful conversation with the few old friends that are still living in Hong Kong, and my worldview on many things is often not shared with my friends." So the subtractive identity is not absent among Hong Kongers, just rare. Ooh. Global identity. Tara, I think, exemplifies this. She and I were chatting, and this is often common with people who have spent a lot of time in other countries. Let me just see. So here is a Hong Konger who said, "I made many international moves because my husband was transferred. We lived in Singapore, we lived in Australia, we went to the University of Michigan for graduate school. So it's like departure and reentry many times. It's actually a series of moves rather than a single move. So I think, when I think about myself, I think of myself as being cosmopolitan, because of all the contacts I've made and all the experiences I had." So the global person is one who doesn't feel any particular allegiance to one place, who feels comfortable everywhere they go, who adjusts very quickly, makes friends quickly, and actually uses the words, "I feel like a global citizen, I feel international or intercultural." Okay. Now, the additive identity is the one that most describes the Hong Konger coming back. And this is not losing your home cultural identity, but adding on a second identity. And this was found in about 75% of the Hong Kongers who I interviewed. Let's see. So here was one. This was interesting because this was, I don't know how many of you remember Albert Chang. He was a radio personality, and he ran for Hong Kong legislature in 2004. And he was quite critical of the Hong Kong government. And there were articles in the South China Morning Post about him. But what was interesting is he had lived in Canada and was a return migrant. And so in the Toronto Globe and Mail, they quoted him saying, "I have to stand up against violence and against any evil force that wants to shut me up. That's a Canadian value. It's something I learned in Canada." So this is learning and incorporating the values from another culture. It's not unique to Hong Kong. You find it in other cultures as well. So here was an American who had lived in China who was very much experiencing this additive identity. And she said, "I feel dejection at not being able to communicate to others the intensity of my China experience. I was expecting to be much the same person I was before going to China, but I was no longer that person. I was so saturated with my Chinese experience that I felt I was half Chinese. I may have looked like the same blue-eyed, light-haired Westerner, but a significant part of me had changed radically. I wanted to discuss these changes with my friends and have them acknowledged, but nobody wanted to listen." So these four identities or profiles or ways of managing learning about culture is something that I investigated. and found, as I've already mentioned, that most Westerners have this subtractive identity, and also it's accompanied by distress, unhappiness. People going back home are just not happy. What was, and of course the reason we do research, is that this model doesn't apply to the Hong Konger coming back. So you all know the statistics, about 800,000 people left because of handover anxiety before 97. We estimate about 500,000 have returned. Those are often referred to as boomerangs, which was somewhat of a pejorative moniker, I think, but in fact is quite descriptive. And let me just say that in terms of the cultural experience of these returnees, you're going to start to see a pattern here, that they have identity flexibility and linguistic flexibility and psychological flexibility. Are you seeing a pattern? Cognitive flexibility, behavioral, and attitudinal. One of the most remarkable parts of interviewing Hong Kong returnees was their ability to adapt so well and so easily. And also in terms of work ethic flexibility, being able to adjust to living and working in Australia, for instance, and to be able to return to Hong Kong and resume a work schedule that was 6 days a week. In fact, one of the most interesting parts of interviewing return migrants had to do with work ethic. Many of the returnees, although they claimed that they were happy in Australia, that the Australians were friendly people, many of them said that they never were happy in the workplace. So I said, why? They said, I could only work 5 days a week. I said, yeah, with my American thinking, that's nice. And I had to leave work at 5 o'clock. Yeah, I'm waiting for, like, what's the problem here? And one after another would tell me that this didn't fit their sense of doing a good job, that a good job was not leaving at 5, so they would stay till 9 o'clock, or they would stay till 10 o'clock, which annoyed their coworkers no end, and in fact, even annoyed their bosses who were leaving at 5 o'clock too. And many of them said, you know, my bosses would say to me, go home. And one fellow said, I thought, what am I supposed to do at 5 o'clock? He didn't even have the behavioral repertoire of, like, what happens in the evening? What do you do? So he asked his coworkers, what do you do when you go home? And some of them said, you know, well, I go jogging, I ride my bike, I go out with my children, I take my wife to the movies. He actually had to learn what to do when he wasn't at work. And he adjusted. He said he liked to ride his bike and take his wife to the movies, but unfortunately, he never felt that he was really doing a good job. He always felt it was a half day. And so when he came back to Hong Kong, one aspect of that really pleased him was being able to get back to work, to feel comfortable again. 6 days a week was terrific. Okay, so I have lots of examples of each one of those, but I'm going to wait, and we can talk about them during the question and answer period. One of the questions is, why additive? Why are so many Hong Kongers additive? And I think that we have a couple of answers, and one of them has to do with the Confucian roots of Asia and of Hong Kong. And I'll just read one more quote or a story that sort of exemplifies this idea of the fact that life is always changing and you need to adjust to it. There was an old farmer whose only horse ran away. Knowing that the horse was the mainstay of his livelihood, his neighbors came to commiserate with him. "Who knows what's good or bad?" said the old man, refusing their sympathy. Indeed, a few days later, his horse returned, bringing with it a wild horse. The old man's friends came to congratulate him this time. Rejecting their congratulations, the old man said, "Who knows what's bad or good?" As it happened, a few days later, when the old man's son was attempting to ride the wild horse, he was thrown and broke his leg. The friends came to express their sadness about the son's misfortune. Well, you know what the old man said, right? "Who knows what's good or bad?" said the old man. As it happened, the army came to the village to conscript all able-bodied men to fight a war against a neighboring province. But the old man's son was not fit to ride and was spared, and so on. So, you know, with this kind of story and value, that life is constantly changing, you need to be flexible, you need to adjust. There's a whole philosophical history behind this additive idea. Taoist teachings, also the international nature of Hong Kong, and the history of multiple identities. This also says, when visiting a new town, follow their customs. And this idea, this is also a Henry Steiner design. The multiple identities that Hong Kongers start with at the very beginning, even before they leave. Now, just a few minutes about mainlanders coming home, because I know that I need to end and give you time for questions. There's no exact parallel in terms of mainland returnees, because there's so few return migrants. That is, people who actually immigrated from China and have returned. The largest number are the return sojourners. And these tend to be students. There are about 1.5 million mainlanders who left as students, and about 25% of them have returned. So most of the research has focused on this group. And my question was, are they going to also have additive identities? Are they going to embrace the other cultures and be bicultural as the Hong Kongers? And what I'm finding is actually two responses. One is the affirmative identity, and that mostly focuses on the political dimension. That is, mainlanders who are educated in college in the US find that their Chinese identity is strengthened as a result of living in the US. But it's mainly in terms of the political dimension. So when they're asked about Chinese politics, they wind up actually being more nationalistic than a sample that never left the mainland. But when it comes to the sense of self, their self-concept, they are additive. That is, they have adapted both a Western and a Chinese way of looking at the world and their place in the world. So there are actually two, this biculturalness that can be switched depending on the situation. I think I'm going to end there with this last slide from Confucius, and that is, I think we can have some implications of this research and thinking about public policy and ways in which we can make some practical use of this. So thank you, and let's have a conversation.
Thanks very much. Now we have microphones, so if you want to raise your hand and give us your name and tell us where you're from when you're asking a question, that would be great. But I'd like to kick it off
by asking, what are the practical uses of understanding, I guess what you're saying, that Hong Kong people are unique?
Right. You know, I think the most important part of their experience is the fact that they have become more creative in problem solving, right? One, there's some interesting new research showing that one of the main benefits of living in a second culture or third culture is creativity. People are more innovative and more creative when they have multiple perspectives to bring to bear on a problem. And so you have hundreds of thousands of Hong Kongers who are returning with this capacity for innovative thinking. And business, government, educational institutions should take advantage of the abilities that Hong Kongers possess and not try and straitjacket them into, you know, sort of towing the line, but allowing for their creativity.
Thank you. Questions over here?
Yes.
Thank you for your fascinating talk. I'm Marketa Moore from Chinese University.
Mm-hmm.
I am also very interested in this topic of study, and I wonder whether you found interesting or useful the concept of hybridity. Whether you use also like a class analysis in your sample. Because I think the examples you mentioned are usually middle class people or people who are moving because of work.
Yes.
And also in your slide, you mentioned on mainlanders, you mentioned ABC, BBC, and there was another acronym, BTC.
Yes, yeah. Back to China.
Okay.
Let me mention, let's start about this notion of hybridity, which is another word for blending. And there is a school of thought that, you know, that this blending or hybridity is a way of describing the experience of Hong Kongers. And my colleague at Hong Kong Baptist University, KB Chan, is a proponent of that people combine and actually form a new culture from their experiences. And I did find evidence of some hybridity or blending. So people would talk about their cooking styles, you know, blending Chinese and Western. You know, one who said that when he was in Australia, he learned to like grilled steak, but he would only eat it with rice. So, you know, the people had ways of combining. On the other hand, one arena where you'd think there'd be blending would be language. And in fact, there's very little evidence of the Chinglish phenomenon in Hong Kong. That is, people really haven't combined Chinese and English. What they do is they language switch constantly. And there's a linguist at HKU who has studied teenager returnees, and she tapes them speaking, and she says that there is a very high rate of switching between Cantonese and English words, you know, 20, 30, 40 times in an utterance. So that's more of evidence for the biculturality. In terms of class, you know, the 800,000 who left Hong Kong were quite unique in that they were almost entirely middle class, very high percentage of professionals, and they immigrated as a family, sometimes two and three generations of a family. Compared to prior immigrations from Hong Kong, which were primarily just the men and workers, you know, for railways and so forth in the past. So this was somewhat of a unique group that immigrated, but it also made it one that was easier to study because they were more homogeneous. Yeah.
Over here.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about the longer-term heritage of Hong Kong.
Pardon me?
The longer-term heritage of Hong Kong, because many of the people who risk-managed by heading off to Canada or other countries were people who, in precisely the previous generation, had had to immigrate to Hong Kong from mainland China. So maybe there's actually a mindset that was built into those people from their early youth about how you needed to have the flexibility and the ability to change and the ability to up sticks and adapt to a new environment. And I wonder whether that's actually very unique to Hong Kong in the world.
Right. That's a very good question. And there are some Hong Kong scholars also from HKU who wrote a book called Leavers and Stayers, something like that, which investigated the thought process of people who were contemplating leaving and staying and what the variables were that influenced them. And part of their decisions had to do with whether they had either had to flee China or if they had family still in China. So what their personal relationship was with China. Some of them who fled were terrified, and so that motivated them. But you know, I think that's a good question in terms of this this particular population may be unique for why they left.
Over here.
Hello. Yeah, this is Ken from Tom Group. I saw this very interesting result from you, where the Chinese or in Hong Kong tend to be more sort of inclusive of the foreign, you know, culture additive.
Yes.
Whereas your research on the Westerners, they tend to sort of subtractive, right?
Yes.
Now and also in Chinese history, for the last 5,000 years, it has always been trying to simulate the foreign culture, like, you know, the Mongolian, it become part of China. The Manchurian, you know, they took over China for 200 years and they become Chinese. They adopted all the culture. So going forward, this characteristic of Chinese able to incorporate better, assimilate, maybe because of the Confucius teaching, maybe all that, would that mean that going forward for the next 30, 40 years, as China, with the population, the growth and everything, you know, its culture will start simulate all the different international culture and create a new culture for the whole world? Whereas for the past 20 years, it has been American culture, you know, going through the whole world, right?
Right.
Every single country is going through Americanization. So going forward, do you think it will be something like that happening?
Yeah, you know, I think that because of the very long history of incorporating other cultures, I mean, that is an adaptive way of dealing with a, you know, a global environment, is to include other cultures. I mean, all of us who have been going back and forth to the mainland for 15, 20 years have seen the remarkable changes that are going on, and many of them are including other cultural behaviors and values and traits at a remarkably fast rate. Right. So I think that's evidence for those changes. I think, on the other hand, you know, I think that part of the problem for the U.S. at least has been its lack of ability to really incorporate world values. And the insistence in the U.S. and other Western countries of keeping other cultures out, the movement of English only that's happening in certain countries. You know, we were just chatting at lunch, and although I'm not a political scientist, from a psychological point of view, I think one of the reasons that Obama has had such a difficult time is Americans are uncomfortable with the fact that he has some international experience. The fact that he lived in Indonesia, the fact that he was born in Hawaii, although Trump still says that he really wasn't born in Hawaii, but those things are not embraced by the American public. They aren't signs of somebody who knows how to be inclusive and multicultural. Rather, it somehow taints him as not really American. So I think it's to some peril for the United States to maintain this attitude of either or. You know, you have to be American or you're another culture, but you can't be both.
We have time for one more question. I'm just going to go right here. And then I think Professor Sussman will be here afterwards. So if you want to
be happy
to chat, please do.
What interests me is that obviously centuries ago we all lived in villages and married your cousin or whatever. Now I find it interesting that the guidebook of the world is called Lonely Planet. Do you think people are unhappier now that they've got more choice?
You know, I think that we have to answer that culturally. You know, I think in some cultures, I have to say I've been impressed with the Hong Kongers' adaptability, and they don't seem at all unhappy with the ability to incorporate, you know, an additive identity. On the other hand, my research shows that Westerners are increasingly unhappy because they are finding it difficult to incorporate, maybe not as an individual, but returning home to countries that don't welcome somebody who has multiple cultural identities. So, you know, I work at a university where I am always encouraging students to have international experiences and to study abroad and so forth. But in the back of my mind, I know that they are going to have a difficult road when they come home because their family is not interested in their experiences. And the response of many of my students when they get back is, I never talk to my family anymore about what I went through living in Paris or Venezuela or, you know. So it's a difficult adjustment. So to some extent, it's hard. On the other hand, I put them together with other kids who've been overseas. We have what we call a Bintu club, which is not people who, it's not, you know, an African tribe. It's people who've been to Japan and been to China. And we get them together so that they can at least have a community of people to share those experiences. So the expat community continues to grow. Maybe that becomes our new community. Not our village back home.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to leave it here. It's 2:00, and we all have to get back to our lonely planet outside of busy people. Professor Sussman, a gift to thank you for coming today, and to everyone else, please enjoy your afternoon.
Thank you very much for coming today.
I know.